Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, who explains why many pro-choice groups like hers will oppose passage of any health care reform legislation that includes restrictions on women's rights. Dr. Aram Ayalon, an Israeli-American and associate professor of education, who recounts the events which led to his support for the rights of Palestinians to build their own nation. And Tom Jurevich, professor of labor studies, discusses his new book, At the Altar of the Bottom Line, The Degradation of Work in the 21st Century. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On Christmas Day, Chinese authorities sentenced leading dissident Liu Xiaobo, co-author of the reform manifesto Charter 08, to 11 years in prison on the vague charge of inciting to subvert state power used regularly to jail dissidents. The Charter 08 manifesto calls for an end to one-party rule. The harsh sentence surprised Western governments and human rights groups that followed Liu's case. The former university professor was detained for a year and was arrested a day before Charter 08 was released. Over 10,000 Chinese activists have signed the reform declaration in spite of a news blackout and internet censorship of the document. The Obama administration called for Liu's release, and other Western governments expressed shock at the harsh sentence. Liu's wife, Xia, told the Associated Press he hopes to be the last person punished for practicing free expression. He thinks the government is aware that this is illegal and wrong. Tang Viano, a Beijing human rights lawyer and signer of Charter 08, says Liu was singled out because of his past defense of pro-democracy activists 20 years ago in Tiananmen Square. Tang told the Christian Science Monitor, "The Chinese Communist Party is afraid of a union of intellectuals and common people, of the strengthening of civil society." The Obama administration sped up its campaign to close the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in late December by releasing 20 prisoners to foreign countries. The administration is also planning to transfer some Guantanamo detainees to a high-security prison in Illinois. With 200 detainees still in Guantanamo, the White House is moving ahead on its stated goal of closing the prison by January 2010, 1 year after President Obama was sworn into office. Congressional Republicans have opposed efforts to close down the detention center, transfer detainees to U.S. prisons, or putting high-profile terrorism suspects on trial in civilian courts. According to the Christian Science Monitor, nearly half the remaining Guantanamo detainees are from Yemen, whose release may become more difficult in the wake of the attempted bombing of an airliner by Nigerian Umar Farul Abdulmutallab, who boasted of contacts with Al-Qaeda operatives in Yemen. Over the past year, the Obama administration has funded a secret war in Yemen to fight Islamic militants. Hawks, like Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, have called Yemen the next front in the war on terrorism. A year ago, Florida-based Gainesville Regional Utility ran a small renewable energy program that provided incentives for small-scale solar power. But interest was low, as the program only generated 300 kilowatts of green energy. Then, the Florida utility observed how a renewable energy program was run in Germany, which allows consumers to sell electricity back to the utility at a competitive price. Through the program, known as the National Feed-in Tariff, Germany has boosted its green power production from 1% in 1995 to 14% in 2007. In March, the Gainesville utility established its own feed-in tariff program, which was a big hit. According to The Nation magazine, the utility pays twice the going rate for each kilowatt of solar power it buys. The first year quota of 4 megawatts of power was sold out in 2 weeks, and the program now has a waiting list until 2016, drawing interest from commercial investors. States and municipalities from Vermont to California have created feed-in tariff programs to boost green energy production. In the early 1990s, a 2-kilowatt solar panel could produce 40% of a household's energy needs. Today, a similar system produces 65% of a household's energy requirements. A critical roadblock to expanding the production of green energy is the lack of a solid commitment from the federal government. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
When the U.S. Senate passed their version of health care reform on Christmas Eve, President Obama and the Democratic Party leadership hailed the vote as historic, moving the nation closer to providing medical coverage to millions of Americans currently without health insurance. But as the House and Senate now prepare to negotiate a merger of their two bills into one for a final vote, many progressive health care activists are angry that the Senate legislation was considerably weakened by excluding a public government-run health insurance option and other reforms that were part of the House bill. But another major obstacle to final passage of health care reform are provisions in both the House and Senate bills that restrict a woman's right to abortion. The STOOP Act Pitts amendment in the House bill prevents anyone who receives public subsidies from purchasing a health insurance plan that covers abortion. In the Senate, Ben Nelson, Democrat of Nebraska, tried but failed to win support for the STOOP Act Pitts language, but after threatening to join Republicans in a filibuster, Nelson succeeded in forcing inclusion of anti-abortion provisions. Nelson's amendment allows states the option of prohibiting abortion coverage in exchange plans and mandates that insurance companies create two different systems if they provide women comprehensive coverage. Individuals who choose a health plan that includes abortion would be forced to write two separate checks, one for abortion care and one for everything else. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, who explains why many pro-choice groups like hers will oppose passage of any health care reform legislation that includes restrictions on women's rights.
The so-called Manager's Amendment, the Reed-Nelson Compromise in the Manager's Amendment, it actually has different language than the Stupak-Pitts Amendment, which did pass in the House. The effect of Stupak-Pitts Amendment is to make it so onerous for insurance companies to provide for abortion coverage that ultimately there would be no market even for private insurance coverage of abortion, which is a real step back. Currently, 87% of private insurance companies do cover abortion care. And that's what passed in the House as the Stupak-Pitts Amendment. The pro-choice organizations organized immediately and were very vocal and lobbied the Senate very hard, and we defeated an attempt to put the Stupak-Pitts language into the Senate bill. But after we won that battle, the manager's amendment came back and essentially has, in different language, the same effect as the Stupak-Pitts amendment. Under the manager's amendment that passed in the Senate, any exchange that provides abortion insurance, if you're in that exchange and you're in a plan in the exchange and the plan contains abortion coverage, you have to write two checks every month. You have to write one small check for the coverage of abortion care and then a large check for everything else. And near as I can tell, reading the language, that applies whether you're male or female, whether you think you'll ever need to have that abortion care or not. So it's pretty clear that people will not write two checks, and they won't opt into any plan that covers abortion. So the exchanges are probably not even going to have abortion care covered. And it's also true under the Senate plan and the manager's amendment that every state would be permitted to completely bar any exchange in that state from covering abortion services. According to the George Washington University School of Public Health, the manager's amendment, like the Stupak-Pitts amendment in the House, both will ultimately have the same effect of shutting down any market for private insurance as well as publicly supported insurance of abortion care. So it's a terrible blow to women, and from the point of view of the National Organization for Women, the bill should be killed.
Is there a way around it? Do you have an alternative that could if not satisfy both sides here, at least move this issue off the table as to not be destructive to women's rights here in this healthcare reform battle.
Well, no. I mean, understand that one of the sides here is the Catholic bishops and extremist ideologues like Bart Stupak. And what they see is an opening where they can make abortion care unavailable to women across the board. This is their goal. And by the way, the Catholic bishops are not stopping at abortion. Their next goal will be emergency contraception and other forms of birth control. And I'm not making this up. All you have to do is go to the Catholic directives that control the kinds of care that Catholic hospitals are permitted to provide to women and to same-sex couples and to people at end of life and to men who want vasectomies. There's a whole range of health care that Catholic hospitals under the Catholic directives are required to provide non-standard care, in other words, substandard care. Preventing women from having access to abortion is just the first step in the Catholic bishops' overarching goal to really control what kind of health care can be provided in this country according to their own religiously informed lights of what it means to be, in their view, pro-life.
Your allies in the House and Senate, are they prepared to derail the health care legislation as a whole over this particular issue of abortion?
Yeah, I certainly hope they are. I know some of them are. I have been very busy. My now leaders around the country have been calling their representatives. And what we are asking our representatives in the House and what we're asking our senators, our allies in the Senate, to do is to vote against the entire packet, at least vote against the entire packet if it goes beyond current law. I have had so many conversations with legislators on the Hill, and I have not been able to convince them to vote against the entire packet because it contains the Hyde Amendment. But I have said, I have made headway in saying, well, at least will you vote against it if it goes beyond current law? And I have had quite a few legislators who say, yes, I will vote against the entire packet if it goes beyond current law.
In the House, there's some margin of votes that they can play around with. But in the Senate, if one senator in the Democratic caucus votes against it over the abortion restriction provisions, that could be the trigger that would derail it in the Senate. Do you have any votes in the Senate that could accomplish that goal for you?
I think what we really need is leadership from the White House at this point to show that we did elect a pro-choice president, a man who understands that it doesn't really do you any good to have a constitutional right if you are prevented from exercising that constitutional right. He is pro-choice. He campaigned as a pro-choice candidate, and I think that it's really important for him now to step up and show leadership, which is the reason that we elected him.
That was Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women. For more information on the group's campaign to oppose abortion restrictions within health care reform, contact now at area code 202-628-8669 or visit their website at now.org. December 27th marked the one-year anniversary of Israel's assault on Gaza, in which 1,400 Palestinians died in the three-week military invasion, more than half of them civilians, including some 200 children. To mark the anniversary, and in solidarity with the 1,300 activists from 42 nations who converged in Egypt last week with plans to enter Gaza via the Rafah border crossing, events were held around the world demanding an end to the blockade of Gaza, which is home to 1.5 million Palestinians and has been closed off by both Egypt and Israel. Egypt refused to allow the international activists entry into Gaza, harassing, detaining, and arresting some as they attempted to make their way to the border. Egyptian security police broke up a nonviolent commemoration of the Israeli invasion of Gaza organized by the Gaza Freedom March at an Egyptian bridge that crosses the Nile River near Cairo. One of the speakers at a solidarity event in Hartford, Connecticut on December 27th, sponsored by a dozen local groups, was Dr. Aram Ayalon, an Israeli-American who is an associate professor of education at Central Connecticut State University. The following is a portion of his brief talk in which he recounts the events which led to his support for the rights of Palestinians to build their own nation.
We all came to our consciousness at this at different time in our development, and my initial real consciousness raising came in 1982 with the massacre of Sabra and Shatila, and I was just a newcomer in the United States and a student in the University of Arizona, and just spontaneously I went and the next day and participated in a demonstration with my with the Palestinian, American Palestinian brothers and sisters of mine, and on the campus of the University of Arizona. And it was a watershed moment for me where a lot of the things I was brought up on kind of hit me in the face. But it's not to say that I didn't have the foundation. I think people forget that there used to be some leftist Zionism, even though it now sounds contradiction. Fourth grade, I was in a youth movement, as a leftist Zionist movement, and she told me, I remember, fourth grade level, that there were two nations in this country, the Palestinians and the Israelis, and both, and the Jews, and both have the same, at least the same rights for this country. And that was in fourth grade. So I had my base, my foundation. So the Sabra and Shatila massacre was the, for me, a watershed moment. And then there came many more moments that I don't have the time to tell all of them. But there were a few. In 1995, I was in Israel on sabbatical with my family, and I participated in the demonstration in the Kikar Malchei Israel, the center of Tel Aviv, with the Prime Minister Rabin and the and delegations from Morocco, Egypt, and so on, for peace. And I was actually 100 yards from where Rabin was assassinated, right there. And that was another watershed moment. And I think in 14 years, we haven't seen any leader anymore coming to support peace and reconciliation. So that was another watershed moment. Of course, there's many more. There's the Lebanese war. There is, and the latest is Gaza. There's really no excuse for what my country is doing. There's no excuse and there's no apology. And I think it is important to know that not all Israelis, there's not many, but there are organizations very brave that are standing there in front of the checkpoints and challenging the soldiers, are supporting, are working with their Palestinian brothers and sisters. And I'll tell you the truth, that since I've been here in the United States, the closest I felt was with my Palestinian brothers and sisters, and I think we share more than our differences. So I'm here to raise a voice of at least one Israeli, and there's many more, and I think they're growing. The numbers are growing, and there are Israelis who are trying now to introduce the curriculum about the Nakba, about the Palestinian Holocaust of 1948. There's hope. I think we need to work together, Palestinian Jews, Arabs, and Israelis, to bring just and peace in the Middle East. Unless there will be justice for the Palestinians, there will never be peace in the Middle East. And finally, I would like to point out that we're meeting here in what is the was the first synagogue in Connecticut. And right behind me, on the window, it says there's 10 commandments. And one commandment says, Lo tirzach, don't murder. And I think what has been going on in Israel toward the Palestinian is murder. And this is forbidden, so it's time to change this. Thank you.
That was Dr. Aram Ayalon, an Israeli-American and associate professor of education at Central Connecticut State University, speaking at a Gaza Solidarity event in Hartford, Connecticut. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on the campaign to lift the Gaza blockade, visit the Code Pink website at codepinkforpeace.org. As 2010 begins, American workers are confronting some of the hardest times since the Great Depression. With unemployment in double digits, record home foreclosures, and bank loans difficult to secure, workers lucky enough to be employed often are forced to get a second and third job just to pay the rent, put food on the table, and handle soaring college tuition and health care costs. But U.S. corporate media, by and large, ignore telling the stories of working Americans, their struggles, and the sacrifices made. However, in his new book, At the Altar of the Bottom Line, The Degradation of Work in the 21st Century, Tom Jurevich, professor of labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, paints a compelling portrait of workers making a living in four different industries in his state. In the spirit of prize-winning author Studs Terkel, known for his in-depth interviews with ordinary people, Jurevich takes us inside the lives of people from a variety of backgrounds, both citizens and immigrants, working at a Verizon call center, a fish processing factory, a hospital, and now a closed machine shop. Through these individual stories, the larger issues of corporate-led globalization and the declining power of unions that confront American workers can be better understood. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tom Jurevich, also an accomplished singer-songwriter, who describes the lives of the workers he interviewed and the common struggles they face to secure a decent wage, improve sometimes unsafe working conditions, and maintain their dignity on the job.
6 years ago, as I began to talk to people informally, you know, people in my neighborhood, my brother-in-law, people I not knew, it was clear that something was going on in the American workplace. So I took about 6 years and interviewed 85 people, not just for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but long interviews, 60 minutes, 75 minutes, a couple of hours in their homes, in diners and coffee shops. And it was really devastating, the kinds of stories that I learned about the American workplace.
Tom, as you talk to these workers over the number of years it took to write this book, At the Altar of the Bottom Line, what were some of the common themes that you heard over and over again from workers who are hanging on to, you know, good-paying or not-so-good-paying jobs and just trying to make ends meet, send their kids to school, you know, have some kind of health insurance? What were some of these common struggles that you heard from the workers?
Well, it is also, it's incredibly amazing when you actually listen to people. And one of the things I think we're so short of in the national media is this idea of the 1 or 2 minute soundbite. But when you sit down with somebody and give them the chance to talk, these kinds of things emerge that, in fact, completely shocked me, even though I'm a sociologist who spent my whole life working and studying work. But I think the other couple things that emerged are equally important. One is, despite these struggles, was how hard people worked to make their lives work for them and their families. This was not a group of workers who had given up in any way, or in some ways weren't even a group of whiners or complainers. They were all working very hard, and that included the Guatemalan undocumented workers who worked two full-time jobs, worked 80 hours a week to try to make ends meet for them and to send some money back home to their families. It included people doing all kinds of alternative schedules so that their families would work. So I think this is really also an important part of this about how hard people are still holding on to a dream for jobs with bread and roses. That phrase comes from a Massachusetts strike from 1912 where textile workers went on strike. And they said, yes, we need the money to be paid, the bread to feed our families, but we also need the roses. We need the dignity and we need the respect be able to both survive on the job, but also to have a life afterwards. And I think that's the third point that I'd like to make that came clear from these interviews, is just how hard it is for people to participate outside of their family in community life and civic life. When people are working 50, 60 hours a week, alternative shifts, are completely exhausted, completely stressed out, it's hard for them to participate in their communities and in political life. And many of them still do. They volunteer, as one of the nurses does, in a program to prevent handguns for violence among children. But it's finding it very hard. And I think that's one of the long-term things that we've got to really think about in this economy. It's not enough just to create jobs and have jobs, but we have to have jobs that allow people to build lives, full lives of bread and roses, and ones where they can be part of their community and build this country into a better place.
Tom Jurevich, as a professor of labor studies and a labor activist yourself, there have been times in our country's history where workers rose up, organized, and were the engine of improving their own lives. Do you see any opportunity in the near future where workers in this horrendous economy we're living through right now with this economic meltdown, could that be a trigger where people will take some steps to get the labor movement re-energized and reorganized to take back some ground that has been lost over recent decades?
Absolutely, Scott. I think, as my old friend Utah Phillips used to say, the most dangerous thing in America is the long memory. I think if we actually look beyond just the last decade or two or three, what we realize is that in many ways the labor movement was born out of tremendous hardship and struggle, whether we're talking about the robber barons, whether we're talking about the Great Depression. So it's not that this is not the first time that working people have faced these kinds of incredibly difficult, hard times. But I think the thing we always need to remember is that, you know, a job in and of itself is not necessarily a good job or a bad job. Auto jobs never started out to be great, unionized, well-paid jobs. They were some of the worst jobs in this country. No different than the kinds of jobs we see now out there, whether we're talking about jobs at Walmart or other jobs in the service industry or among fish processors or nurses or call center workers. But what we recognize when we take that long view of history is it takes organizing in those industries. It takes collective action. And we've got to move beyond this sort of individualism to create some collective struggle. So I think that, you know, right now the labor movement is going through lots of transitions. I mean, we lost much of the industrial labor movement, which formed the core and the backbone of the labor movement. We've got some interesting things going on in the service sector and healthcare, and a lot of other unions. But I think we also need to branch out and to broaden the movement, both to include young people who are struggling in fundamentally different ways, and to also include workers in traditionally occupations that we haven't thought of in terms of the labor movement. So I think there's an awful lot of work to be done, but I think, as I say, we take that long view. It's not as though the labor movement is over in this country. It's not as though it's simply a vestigial organ of a long-gone past.
That was Tom Jurevich, professor of labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of At the Altar of the Bottom Line, The Degradation of Work in the 21st Century. Visit his website at tomjurevich.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.